is superconductivity. And as everyone knows, that was discovered by Camerlingonis, supposedly. So this guy is H. Camerlingonis. In 1911, where he noted the disappearance of the resistance of mercury at 4.2 degrees. Okay, now, why was Camerlingonis the guy who discovered superconductivity, assuming it wasn't done by a graduate student in his lab? But why was Camerlingonis able to discover superconductivity?
Because he was a specialist in low temperature physics.
Well, even more. One of the very few. What were you going to say, Johnny?
I basically
said
that.
Yeah, yeah, because he had very recently been the first person to liquefy helium-4. Okay, and helium-4 boils or becomes liquid at 4.2 Kelvin, and the critical temperature of mercury is right around there. It's just a little bit below 4.2. Now, there's a wonderful television show, or maybe even series, called, I think it's The Search for Absolute Zero. It's a PBS show. Has anyone seen that? No? Quest, I think you're right. It's probably, yeah, I couldn't remember, but yeah, The Quest for Absolute Zero. And it's about this intense competition between the British low temperature school and the Dutch low temperature school to liquefy successively more and more difficult gases, hydrogen and then helium. So that was a PBS show. Okay, so let me just ask the question, what was Camerlingonis looking for? Okay, so typically when experimentalists do experiments, they like to have a theory. They like to have an idea of what they're looking for. It doesn't actually matter so much whether the theory is correct. It simply provides a experimental a framework for planning and design. So what was he looking for? Well, what had he seen? Let me see if I can draw this. I'm still avoiding the use of PowerPoint. This is the temperature in degrees Kelvin. And this is the resistance in, I can tell you. Oh, no. It's probably kilo-ohms or something. 0.1 ohms. I'm not quite sure what the units are here. Okay. But anyway, so what he had seen were curves like this. Well, actually, curve like this thing should be flatter. He had seen something that looked like this. Okay, so this was platinum. And this was gold with some level of impurities. Call this gold. This is gold with 0.0015 atomic percent impurities. And this was gold with 0.005 atomic percent impurities. And so basically what he saw was these things flattening out. So, I mean, just to give you a feeling for the way he was thinking, basically what he said in, okay, so in his Nobel lecture, so he got the Nobel Prize in 1913, which is pretty good, actually, for something that you did in 1908 and 1911. Okay, so what he said is, he talked about building this cryostat that allowed him to cool things to helium, liquid helium temperatures. He says, with this cryostat, investigations into the extraordinarily great conductivity of some metals at low temperatures were possible, and I wish now to report on these. Even the very first experiments on the resistance of metals had brought very surprising results. With platinum wire, which is this, there was no re-rise in resistance after reaching a minimum. So if what he was sort of thinking is that maybe it would do that. But he found there was no re-rise in the resistance after reaching a minimum, as would be expected if the electrons which provide the conduction were firmly frozen to the atoms at low temperatures. So one theory of metals was that you cool them down, the resistance gets lower and lower, but eventually all the electrons freeze onto the atoms, and you're left with an insulating state, so the resistance just goes zooming up again. The conclusion drawn from the results of an experiment carried out with Mr. Clay, who is, I assume, a technician, down to the freezing point of hydrogen, was that for absolutely pure platinum, resistance would disappear at the boiling point of helium. So he could extrapolate. So here, actually, this particular picture that I'm drawing for you is with gold, okay, where he successively added and then removed, worked with smaller amounts of impurities. The impurities just scatter electrons. They're just like that X in the last lecture that scatters. And he actually could extrapolate. In his lecture, he has the picture for gold looking something like this.
We know that even at T equals zero, the electrons can be in bands in the atom. Why did they freeze out?
Yeah, well, this was 1913. Okay, so they didn't actually know all this stuff. So there were different pictures. And I think the band theory came later as quantum mechanics was applied more broadly. So, you know, they were sort of grasping, you know, groping around in the dark. Okay, this is the case where an experiment provides essential guidance. Okay, so the idea that the existence of a pure metal would disappear at some temperature, you say in the case of gold or platinum, is also incorrect. You would simply need to blow up your resistance scale, or nowadays, you know, turning the knob on your nano-ohmmeter, or actually, I'm sorry, I'm talking about 30-year-old technology, like they do now. in any case, you could easily measure the resistance of gold down to very low temperatures, and it probably, almost certainly, would eventually become flat, if only due to a size effect, like the mean free path might become comparable to the size of your wire. But anyway, so these are what happened with these metals. And then he did mercury. Now let me put this, there's a classic picture for mercury, but actually this one's sort of nicer, which looks like this. This is supposed to be 4.2. And there's like little points down here. And so what happened here is that the resistance was screaming along down, and then at a certain point, it just dropped to to an extremely low value. Now maybe there was a point or two here where he could actually measure a value, and then basically it was the limit of his resolution as to what he could measure. So that was the discovery of superconductivity, the disappearance. Of resistivity in mercury, solid mercury, at 4.2 Kelvin. Why did he use mercury? Any guess? I mean, I don't know from personal experience, but just what he says. So he says that he was able to purify it. I guess the point is that most of the impurities that we would have in these metals would just separate out from mercury. I'm not quite sure how he did it, though. I haven't read about that. Okay. So that was a fantastic discovery, and there were other superconductors that he could tin, lead. I guess lead has a higher TC. I think tin's maybe similar. Aluminum is lower. I'm not sure if he could quite get to aluminum. The disappearance of resistance. Okay. So this is perfect conductivity. In terms of that Drude model that I wrote down for you last time, that corresponds to saying that the transport lifetime is infinite. Okay, and that's quite a remarkable thing, and it means, for instance, that you could, if you can figure out cleverly how to start a current going in a ring of superconducting metal, that the current would keep going forever. Okay, and there's actually detecting circulating currents is pretty easy. So you can tell that it's continuing to go around because basically it creates a magnetic field which you can detect. You can tell that with extraordinary accuracy, and so you can show that the lifetime of that current to decay is longer than, not only longer than the patience of any experimentalist, but also longer than more astronomical quantities. Okay, and but nevertheless, you can associate that with perfect conductivity. Also perfect screening. So imagine that you have a superconducting sample. And you apply a magnetic field. So how do you do that? You have the sample there. And then you turn on a magnetic field. And what you will find is that by turning on the magnetic field, you induce currents in the superconducting thing, which causes the field to not to be able to penetrate. Okay? So also, what you would expect from perfect conductivity. Okay, that if you try to turn on a magnetic field, you just induce like Lenz's law, you get currents going in the opposite direction, and they're just enough to keep the field from going into the sample. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry.
If the field is strong enough, it can be metric.
The field is
strong enough. The magnetic field.
Isn't there a transition there a strong enough?
Well, wait. Don't jump ahead.
Yeah.
If the conductivity is perfect, then and that's all you knew, and there's a lot of electrons, okay, and you didn't know why it was doing this, you just said the conductivity is perfect, the answer would be no, it'll just keep screening, okay? Now you might say, okay, but there must be some nonlinear effect which eventually limits that, and it goes in, some little heating thing occurs, and bam, it's in.
But that's not the point, okay? The point is that generically what you expect from a perfect conductor is that if you turn on the field, it will screen out. If the currents will spontaneously rise to screen out the field, okay? So all of this you can associate with perfect conductivity. However, so it took another 20 years, I think,
to discover sort of a additional wrinkle to this behavior, which was actually much more surprising than the idea that the resistance could be exactly zero. And that's called the Meister effect. And let me see, I don't know if I put the date down. I probably didn't. I think it's like 1931 or something like that. Okay, so this experiment is different from this imagined experiment or this real experiment. I mean, they did this experiment too, of course, but not the way I drew it. So imagine that you do a different experiment. You take this sample, this superconducting sample, but at high temperatures, it's not superconducting. And you apply a magnetic field, and for sure, for a normal metal, the field will go right through the superconductor, right through space, no problem. Okay? So then the question is, what happens if you cool this chunk of metal down below into its superconducting state? And the remarkable answer is the so-called Meissner effect, that what happens is that all these field lines get pushed out, and you end up exactly where you were over here. Okay? So that's a different phenomenon. Okay? Because what would you expect if this thing were a perfect conductor below TC, below the transition temperature? And you, at higher temperatures, you had a field going through it. What would you expect to happen? Say that? Basically, it would be like, it almost worse, like it couldn't move, right? You know, you think, how's it going to move? You might expect it to get stuck. But yeah, for it to be a constant, that's exactly what you would expect to see. Okay, and instead, nothing like, it's the opposite happens, it just pops out. Okay, and this Meissner effect is the effect that, well, with a lot of qualifications and ifs and buts, it's the thing that allows you to levitate magnets above superconductors and things like that. The fact that the superconductor wants to push out the flux. Okay. So now, right away, that tells you what I guess Prasanna maybe said, that if you turn on too high a field, it's going to destroy the superconductivity. Okay, and in fact, it's called HC. And this HC, the critical, so-called critical field, is a function of T. And what happens is that I think it looks like, gosh, I hope I've done this right. looks like that. So what it says, yep, Mark.
But there are superconductors that make that superconductor with very high magnetic field.
Right, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, sorry, I don't understand the difference between the perfect screening and the Meissner effect.
Okay, so the Meissner effect is the expulsion of flux. And the perfect screening is that if you try to put flux into the superconductor, it will resist that.
Oh.
Okay. So the difference arises when you start at high temperatures where it's just a chunk of metal, apply a magnetic field, which happily goes in, and then say what happens at low temperatures. If it's only a perfect superconductor, it'll look like this. If it's only a perfect conductor, it'll do this, like a piece of metal that has an extraordinarily high conductivity.
It won't screen like that?
It won't do anything because the current only responds to changes in the flux. Right. So here, if you're turning on the field, you're trying to change the flux and it drives the current and keeps it out. But here, the flux is already there. So really, this is telling you something totally different, this Meissner effect. What it's telling you is that the superconducting state is a new state for electrons. It's a different state from the one that we've been studying for the last week or so. Okay, the one that we've been studying for the last week or so, basically, it looks as if there were fermionic quasiparticles occupying the volume inside of the Fermi surface, and excitations of those.
This is some different thermodynamic state, and you can destroy it with a magnetic field. Okay? So what that says is that in the superconducting state, the electrons arrange themselves in such a way as to lower their energy for whatever reason it may be. But the way they do that is incompatible with magnetic fields. Magnetic fields, if you like, scramble up what they would like to do and don't let them be superconducting. Okay, that's really what the magnetic field does. Now, maybe, Maurice, do you want me to address this thing about
high superconductors that work at high fields?
Okay.
It's amazing.
The subject of practical superconductivity, like what real materials do, is actually almost like metallurgy. Okay, it's actually very much like metallurgy. One of the things so different superconductors have different properties. Some of them have a very low density of superconducting electrons. I mean, to get this screening that you get here, or to be able to push out magnetic fields, you need some density of superconducting electrons. And some metals have more, some metals have less. Okay? So the more superconducting electrons it is you have, the easier it is to push out magnetic fields. Okay? Also different materials, superconducting state, it's all quantum mechanics. So it's some kind of wave function for the superconducting electrons, which is different from the wave function for the degenerate Fermi liquid. Different kinds of wave functions have their own internal stiffness, or it's easier or harder to distort them. Like, for instance, what you need to do if you're pushing out the field, right where you're pushing out the field, the superconducting wave function gets suppressed a bit. Anyway, these differences, like the so-called penetration depth, which is the distance over which a superconductor screens, or the coherence length, which is the distance over which the superconducting wave function heals itself if you disturb it, distance over which it heals itself, those parameters determine things like the energy of an interface between a superconducting and normal region. Okay, so say you actually destroy superconductivity to the right, and you have a superconductivity to the left. There's an interface energy, and that can be that surface energy can be positive, in which case you want to push all the magnetic fields out, or it can be negative, in which case you want to have as much surface area as you can. And you get these states, which are the so-called vortex states of a type II superconductor, where the magnetic field is not held out. It still can't coexist with the superconducting regions because they don't like magnetic fields. But what happens is that the magnetic field penetrates in the form of quanta of flux with vortex supercurrents flowing around them. And so in that case, you can apply a very large magnetic field without killing the whole superconductor, because what it does instead is it lets some magnetic field in, but only in the normal course of vortices. Okay, this is a lot like a metallurgy problem. This is a lot like how you make something hard or soft, or you know what the role of dislocations and things like that. But it's true. There are different kinds of superconductors. They're called type one and type two. So right now we're talking about type one. So type one superconductors are like a thermodynamic phase. Your electrons are either superconducting or they're not. And in the absence of magnetic fields, the free energy of the superconducting state must be lower than the free energy of the normal electron state, because that's why it becomes superconductive. Okay? And in fact, the free energy of the superconducting state as a function of T minus the free energy of the normal state as a function of T is related to how much of a field it takes to make the system rather be normal than superconducting. It's an energy density over, I can never remember the pi's, 8 pi. Okay. So now, without going into exactly how you calculate this, you get the idea from the argument that I made. But the point that I want to make here is that this means for these kinds of superconductors that are simply destroyed by magnetic fields, in other words, in a simple way, you can actually measure as a function of temperature the difference between the superconducting free energy and the competitor, which is the normal electron state free energy. Okay, and it looks like that. Okay. So how does this happen? Okay, so superconductivity was discovered in 1911, and it was understood on a microscopic basis in 1957, I think. So that's what, 46 years. It's simple quantum mechanics. It's just that Hamiltonian that I wrote down on day one. Okay, non-relativistic quantum mechanics, you just solve Schrodinger's equation. But it took people an awful long time to do that, and they were struggling with why this system behaves the way that they did. And there was a lot of modeling, there was a lot of phenomenology, and conjecture. Okay, so some of the conjecture, I guess it's Fritz London, and what's his brother's name, the other H. London? Does anybody know what the H is for? Is it Henrik? Okay. So those guys were real low temperature experts. Okay, and there's some nice old books, really old books, called Superfluid by Fritz London. So they said, well, we don't know what's going on here. Obviously, quantum mechanics at play. But we conjecture that the ground state of a superconductor must be a state of zero momentum. Okay, so the ground state wave function for a superconducting piece of metal should have, so this is conjectured. And if this is the ground state in the presence of a magnetic field, which means that there is some supercurrent flowing with some velocity, then the canonical momentum is the, you know, mv minus e, or plus ea over c, or if you like, p minus ea over c is the velocity and squared is the kinetic energy, okay, in your Hamiltonian. And so this is the supercurrent. Density. Which is E times the density of superconducting electrons this is phenomenology must equal minus E squared NS A over MC. M from the momentum. Oh, no, M from here, sorry. So that's JS. Now, yes.
Reason for this conjecture? Like, why would the ground state momentum be zero?
In the original paper, he didn't even say that the ground state momentum is zero. He like used some different like very classical approach. Just I mean using the group theorem of conductivity.
Well, okay, this is an evolved explanation of I didn't want to do this on paper. Okay, although I did not. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, so why should the ground state momentum be zero?
It's just, if it had some momentum, I guess, I don't know, my reaction to that, maybe a silly one, is if it had some momentum, what would it be? Why would it be anything?
I don't know, well, we could have conjectured that MV equals zero.
Yeah, but we know that there's a set of states depending on the, if you like, the electromagnetic part of the acting on it, or this part of the state. So we know that it isn't zero.
Okay.
Because if it's keeping the magnetic field out, it's zero. Okay, there has to be some current. Okay, so that's sort of the, this is not a compelling argument, but the point is, now the other thing is that it's also not gauge invariant, so it looks like it depends on the gauge, and so this is all, this statement is only meaningful on a particular gauge. Okay, which is interestingly enough called the London gauge. which has div A equals zero, which means that the divergence of the current is zero. The current is just flowing around. And
A goes to zero inside. So if you're deep in the bulk, that you have to be working in a gauge where the vector potential goes to zero inside. Okay. Okay, so so this is a conjecture as the relationship between the vector potential and the current. Basically, what it's going to tell you is that there is a current which screens out the field. That's what this tells you. Okay, I'll go through some algebra now, but the bottom line is that if you say that there's a supercurrent which is proportional to the vector potential in this gauge, then the supercurrent is going to screen the field out of the sample. Spontaneously, whatever you try to put in gets screened up to a point. Okay. So then let me do the algebra. So I'm using the Tinkham's notation for the local B field, which he actually writes as H. So he would say, so this is the microscopic and I think the reason for that is because in superconductors you can have states like these vortex states where microscopically the field is varying and it's largest in the core and small, it falls off outside the core of the vortices. But macroscopically, you just measure the magnetization of that sample, which is less than it would be if it were not superconducting. Okay, so I think Tinkham reserves the B for sort of the average over macroscopic volumes, and H is sort of like what's happening microscopically on the scale of the microscopic parameters of the superconductor, which are the penetration depth and the coherence length, which themselves are mesoscopic. So if you believe this, this relationship between the supercurrent and the vector potential, then the curl of J is like the curl of A, because J goes like A. And it's also from here equal to H with these constants thrown in, E squared NS over MC with a minus sign. M. Thank you. And then from Maxwell, we know that the curl of H, or H curls around currents, so this means J is C over 4 pi curl of H. So basically, this thing here is curl of the curl of H. And then you put the from from here, you just write J is C over 4 pi curl of H, but then I'm going to put the 4 pi over C on the other side of the equation, minus 4 pi over C E squared N S over M C H. And then the curl of the curl of H is something that's like gradient squared of H and something that involves the divergence of H, which is 0. And there's a minus sign. And so this is minus why don't we write it this way? 4 pi E squared N S over MC squared H. And get rid of the minus signs. So basically, and this thing here, now that I've gotten rid of the minus signs, is 1 over lambda L squared H. Where this is the London penetration depth or length. And so basically what this is telling us is that if you have a field, say, parallel to your surface, decays exponentially like this, where this distance is lambda L. And lambda L typically, so metals, you know, the number of electrons, the size of atoms, all these things are comparable from metal to metal, not exactly. So lambda is on the order of, let's say, 10 to the 2 to 10 to the 4th angstroms. That's quite a wide range, actually. Typically, it's a few hundred angstroms. But basically what you see, this is for different materials, what you see is that the larger the density of electrons that's tied up into this superconducting state, the shorter the penetration depth. Because it's easier for those electrons too. But it's not the only factor, of course. Their effective mass comes in. Charge and the speed of light, yeah, they don't change very much. So it's basically the density and the effective mass comes in. Okay? So that's how it works. Now, so so this doesn't tell us very much. It tells us that this kind of electrodynamics should describe this phenomena, but it doesn't say anything about why you have this phenomena. Okay? So, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. Perfect.
think that strictly saying that there's not correct physical causation. It's because we know that from James Pease's theory, that the properties in the expected that the Lorentz spinning length. It's not found that. It was published in 2006, and then in 2007. And it's already established, but Lambda spinning length is not that simple.
Right, how do you know this?
I was in the practice for the paper.
I don't think this has changed.
Who published it? I can give you the.
Yeah, okay. I mean, fundamentally, if somebody said that it's different from this, the only thing they could mean is that it's different in detail. Okay? They can't mean that it isn't proportional to the density of superconducting electrons and their effective mass or whatever it is, depending on the band structure and stuff like that. And this is not a controversial subject. Although I have to admit, superconductivity itself has suffered from over the years from the fact that it took people much longer to really understand the subject than it took them to solve the problem. Okay, so like BCS, your first approximation, solved the problem. But if you followed people's understanding of superconductivity through the 60s and 70s and 80s, it was pretty clear that they knew the theory, but they didn't understand it that well. And it was because they hadn't learned how to make it simple. Okay? And it was only with the advent, I would say, this is my personal opinion, I'm sure there's any number of people who wouldn't subscribe to this opinion, but it was only with the advent of high-temperature superconductivity that so many people spent so much time trying to work things out that they had to find clear and simple ways of doing it, and then everything just became much, much simpler. So for instance, if you look in the book by Michael Tinkoff about how to calculate the conductivity frequency and wave vector dependent conductivity in a superconductor, it looks horrendously complicated, but there's lots of papers from the 90s where people do things very cleanly and crisply. So there's a lot of evolution. But fundamental question is, these supercurrents, a fundamental question, actually this is fundamental too, but these supercurrents will flow forever. What does that require? What property is it of the superconducting state that allows these supercurrents to flow forever? Since time's getting late, I had sort of like a three-line explanation of this, and then I went back and worked through all the details for my own sake and for yours. So I'll just write down the three-line part now. Okay, superflow. And the question is, what does this require? So imagine that you have superflow in a pipe. You've got some current flowing down the pipe. Going that way. And the pipe is cold. Say the pipe is as close enough to T equals zero that it doesn't matter that it's not. On the other hand, the surface of the pipe cannot be smooth on a microscopic scale. It has to have some roughness. So if you like, putting those two things together, this pipe, which is sitting in your laboratory connected to a refrigerator, in other words, it's sitting at some temperature T, can absorb energy, and it can generate or create or destroy momentum.
okay? It can't emit energy. In other words, it can't, this thing's cold, so it doesn't add energy to the superfluid. Just maintains it at this very low temperature. Now, superconductors aren't the only superfluids, as you know. Bose liquids can be superfluid also in somewhat different ways, but nevertheless, there's some resemblances. Okay? So imagine a, let's consider a, what am I going to call it? Non-interacting condensed Bose gas. Which is actually one of the more pathological systems in nature. So imagine you've got a Bose condensate. It's essentially a T equals zero. You've set it flowing in this pipe. What do its excitations look like? Well, if you're moving in the frame of the Bose condensate, like if you're just living there with that condensate, you'd say, OK, we've condensed into the zero momentum state, and there are no excitations. But sorry, if there were excitations, the excitations cost h bar squared k squared over 2m, where k is the wave vector of the excitation as viewed from the condensate, from the perspective of the condensate. It's just like taking something out of the q equals 0 state, exciting it into some non-zero momentum state. It has an energy h bar squared k squared over 2m. That says cost. So the question is, what is the energy of the excitation as viewed in the frame of the pipe, which is like the lab frame, the frame at which the temperature T is well defined, the frame where your refrigerator is sitting? Okay? So in the frame of the pipe, the excitation energy epsilon of k is equal to h bar squared k squared over 2m plus h bar k dot vs. Equal to this, plus something which you can call a Doppler shift, if you like, which depends on how fast the superfluid is moving. And it depends on the relative direction of k and vs, the wave vector of the excitation and the speed, the direction of the speed of the superflow. Okay. So this is called a, this is like a Doppler shift. It supposedly follows from Galilean invariance. Whenever I read or see those words, my mind goes blank, and so I have to sit down and do a little calculation, which I'll do tomorrow, which makes it all pretty trivial. But the important thing to notice is for this Bose condensate going through the pipe, if an excitation is created in the direction opposite the super, the flow, it has negative energy. Because this is quadratic in k, this is linear for small k. This guy wins. It's got a minus sign if k and vs are opposite. So that says that this excitation has negative energy. That energy and the momentum can be created by the wall. The energy can be absorbed by the wall. That for sure will happen. And so this isn't, this doesn't work. This Bose condensate cannot have superflow through this pipe because there are excitations which are at negative energy, will be absorbed by the walls. They have momentum in the opposite direction, which means the momentum of the whole thing is slowing down. So basically, this whole thing is just going to grind to a halt. Okay? So this non-interacting but Bose-condensed gas cannot be a superfluid. Okay? So that's a really good place to stop. And tomorrow we'll just look at that more closely. Okay, so